nephews, nieces too, mothers and daddies, how are you? This is Uncle Don, all set to go with a meeting on the radio. We'll start off with a little song. To learn the words will not take long, for they're as easy can be. Come on now and sing with me.
When we think back on the golden age of radio, we recall shows like The Shadow, Fibber McGee and Molly, and Amos and Andy. We don't think much about the way radio programming influenced and was influenced by the United States of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and by issues like race, ethnicity, and gender. Michelle Helms has, and she has offered us her thoughts on the subject in her book, Radio Voices, American Broadcasting, 1922 to 1952, published by the University of Minnesota Press. Michelle Helms is a professor of communication arts at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome, Professor Helms.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good. In your book, you talk about the golden age of radio, which you define as lasting from 1922 to 1952. What made that the golden age?
Well, I think that we can definitely say that radio as a medium for drama and comedy and all variety of formats of both fiction and nonfiction has not recovered from what happened in the 1950s when television came in. I think that, you know, that radio reached a peak of creativity during those decades, and it also was the central medium of American culture, American everyday culture. People gathered around the radio the way they do around television now. In fact, I think that we can't even really relate television now exactly to how radio was in the 20s through the 40s. Maybe it's more like television in the 50s and 60s before we all fragmented into cable audiences, et cetera. But certainly in terms of the creativity, the innovation, the talent, the variety of programs that were on the air, I don't believe that we're going probably ever to see another period of innovation like that.
Well, I want to come back to that peak of creativity and innovation, but let me just ask another question in terms of structure of your book. Mm-hmm. You also talk about how you're studying radio not as a succession of technological developments, but rather, quoting you here, as a social practice grounded in culture. What do you mean by that?
Okay. I was reacting when I wrote that to many histories of radio that start out with a technology, and they show us Marconi and various other inventors progressing from the telegraph to radio broadcast technology. And it almost seems as though once the technology was developed, that radio just had to develop in a certain way, as though the technology drove what was made of it, how it was used, how people experienced it, you know, as though it couldn't have turned out any other way. And I wanted to look instead, rather than at the technology, although of course that's very important, at the ways that radio was understood. What did people make of this new medium that could transmit invisibly through the air? What kinds of decisions were made very early on about what was appropriate for the new medium? Should we allow amateurs to simply go on the air freely whenever they felt like it, no licenses or anything, talk about whatever they felt like, play jazz records on the air? Or should we control it and try to shape what was on and keep certain things off the air and put it in the hands of certain people rather than others? And so when I talk about radio as a social practice, I mean on a very broad social level, what kinds of decisions were made about how to develop radio and what kinds of cultural assumptions and prerogatives went into that. And then also how radio was used, how people who invented some of the many forms and varieties of radio, where they came from, how they made up the kinds of programs that they developed, and then how people used radio in the home. You know, how did we experience radio? What kinds of relationships did the stars forge with their fans or their invisible fans sitting out there in the living room listening?
Okay, and that inevitably led to the points I made in my introduction to the issues that you dealt with in your book. Let's take one of them now, the relationship between this golden age of radio and race. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon that, the time that radio was invented, with the time that the technology became available, was the immediate post-War I period. And America was under a lot of social stress during that time. Not only had we just gotten over fighting a war that a lot of people weren't sure we should have been involved in at all and all the upheavals that led to it, but it was also a period of intense immigration. Millions of new Americans came to the shores of the United States during that time. And in 1920, 21, 22, tighter immigration laws were passed. And so it was a time when many Americans were very worried about what our culture was going to be like. Who would be considered Americans? Could we assimilate all of those new cultures? And then, of course, race played into this, because one of the groups in American society that had been problematic, or rather that had been made problematic, were African Americans, with a long history of not only slavery, but all of the restrictive rules that applied back at that time. And so radio, like many other institutions, like law, like films, it should go into culture, responded to the social tensions of the time by handling race in a very gingerly and restrictive way, also by drawing from vaudeville and from the stage traditions like blackface comedy. And so you see early radio, although there was a push to from jazz to include jazz recordings and to include jazz musicians on the air, that radio really went out of its way to try to mark out African-Americanness, that is, who was black on the radio. You couldn't see them. They were invisible. But to mark them out through use of dialect and certain kinds of accents, verbal mannerisms, certain use of grammar, and to really enforce that dialect on African-American performers so that it was impossible for African-American performers largely to appear on radio without speaking in a very stereotypical and manufactured kind of blackface dialect. And if I could go, just to use one example, there's a rather striking example in 1937 when Louis Armstrong, the famous jazz trumpeter, was hosting as a substitute host in the summer for the Fleischmann's Yeast Hour, which is known as the Rudy Valley Show. A musical program in which he was required by the script to speak in a very heavy minstrel-like dialect in a way that, of course, he did not speak at all. He was a well-spoken man, did not have any, he had his own kind of jazz man lingo, but nothing like what NBC wanted. And you can actually see the scripts in the J. Walter Thompson collection where Armstrong refused to speak that way and instead spoke in his own natural dialect, and this created quite a stir, and he was regarded as troublesome by the producers and, in fact, didn't host a radio show again after that.
A good example. You mentioned ethnicity as part of your last answer. Can you give us an example of how that was played out in radio?
Well, it is amazing when you go back and look at old radio programs how much ethnic acts were important to the development of radio, and that carried over, of course, from vaudeville, too, with all the different kinds of, as they call them, Dutch acts. I probably shouldn't use some of the terms they used back then. It might be insulting, but, you know, Italians, Irish, all the old kind of stage ethnic acts carried on to radio. And you can, even on the Jack Benny program, you have many, the Mexican character played by Mel Blanc. On Fred Allen, you had Socrates Mulligan, the stage Irishman, Mrs. Nussbaum, the Jewish housewife. And I think just to kind of encapsulate that, one of the most interesting examples, it's rather a peculiar conjunction. On the Jack Benny show, now Jack Benny was himself Jewish, as was his wife, Sadie Marks, who took the name Mary Livingston. He never referred to his own ethnicity on the show. Jack's own Jewish heritage was never mentioned, and in fact, many, many elements of the Christian religion were incorporated on the show, as in the Christmas program and wearing shopping for an Easter hat and buying Christmas gifts for the cast. So although everyone, many people, knew that Jack Benny himself was Jewish, his Jewishness was erased, and instead, a quote-unquote Jewish character would often appear on the show called Schlepperman, who would speak in an exaggerated Yiddish accent. And this kind of handling of ethnicity, erasing it in some places, but really emphasizing it in others, is a mark of the period. And you can also think of Fibber McGee and Molly. Fibber was, they were both presented as much more heavily Irish in the early years of the show, and that was a little bit downplayed later on.
We've brought in wives here three times. What about the role of, or the place of gender in this golden age?
Well, as you might have guessed, or if you think about Jack, Benny, Mary Livingston, Fred Allen in Portland Hoffa, Fibber McGee and Molly, Burns and Allen, it's interesting, and I think American radio is really unique in the world for this, that, of course, women were very important for radio. First of all, they made up a lot of talent who were available to appear on the air, and they also made up a majority of the audience, and they were important because they were the consumers of the household goods that supported commercial radio broadcasting. And so, as far as I know, in no other country in the world did the broadcasting system develop the kind of segregated day and night hours or schedule of American radio, and it carried over onto television, too. We still see it, where the daytime hours were devoted to women and women's programs, and then the nighttime hours, what we now call prime time, were, we knew, of course, women and men were listening, but the entertainment tended to have a more masculine cast or was directed more at men because it was thought that that's the only time you could catch men at home listening. Not entirely true statistically, but that's the concept. And so you have daytime radio where an enormous variety, more than, I really would have to hold up our broadcasting system as producing a greater variety of programs for women than any other that I found. Soap operas, talk shows, inspirational programs, concerts of music, directed specifically at women. And here we find very well-known women producers and writers like Erna Phillips, Jane Krusenberry, Mary Margaret McBride, building careers in radio, very successful careers, but never allowed on the airwaves at night. In fact, there was a virtual ban, not entirely, but a ban against a serial drama on the airwaves at night, with a few notable exceptions like One Man's Family. And then nighttime radio, you would have the teams carried over from vaudeville, the husband-wife teams of people like, again, Jack Benny, Mary Livingston, Fred Allen, and Portland Hoffa, with the women in the secondary role usually, and often playing that famous vaudeville comedic character, which was referred to as the Dumb Dora. The Dumb Dora was a female role from vaudeville, and I think Gracie Allen is probably the best example of that taken to a wonderful extreme. Mm-hmm. The ditzy character that her husband
she was
has to kind of contain.
Yeah. Okay, she was great. Let me ask you, if I might, about particular shows. Tell us about Amos and Andy, which effectively has been banned from radio now because of its racist overtones. What are your thoughts on that show?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've written on it, and I sometimes play little bits of it in my classes. I'm always a little afraid to do so because of its heavy dialect and obvious racial stereotypes and rather demeaning representations. Of course, the thing about Amos and Andy was that it was a blackface minstrel program. The two men who were Amos and Andy were, in fact, Freeman Gosden and Charles Carell, two white men who had created their act on, actually for radio, but were drawing on other kinds of minstrel shows they had done on stage. And they played two good-natured, innocent, naive black men who, in the story, were migrants from the South who'd moved to Chicago and were trying to establish themselves. They went on the air. It's a very key show. They went on the air in 1926, really could be seen as the forerunner of both situation comedy and serial dramas, and ran off and on, you know, until television, and as we know, actually went on to early TV as well. There have been movements to revive Amos and Andy, and not just by white audiences, but by black actors and actresses who want to honor not only the black TV stars who played in the 50s, but also the fact that a lot of African Americans did enjoy the show. It was the one place on the air where some aspects of African-American life were portrayed, even though by whites and prejudicially. However, I think it's what is a shame about it, and what I think makes it so problematic, is how much African-Americans were neglected by radio and how circumscribed the portrayals of African Americans were, so that Amos and Andy end up being the only way that we could experience blackness, to give it a word, on radio, with other people like Louis Armstrong, you know, also being forced into that kind of ethnic stereotype.
All right. Interesting perspective. Well, we're almost out of time, and I know it wasn't part of your book, but let me just ask you to comment then if you thought the period to 1952 was the golden age. What do you think of radio since then?
Well, you know, I guess it's with things get taken away with one hand and given back with the other. We know that a lot of what was on radio passed on to television, and there's a great heritage there that I wish more people were aware of. Radio became more or less abandoned by the networks. We had the rise of format radio, also the rise of black DJs, and that suppressed African-American culture was allowed to finally come up, and radio became more diverse and more oriented towards marginal groups. It's interesting that we've witnessed a resurgence in talk radio in the last 10, 15 years, which seems to get back a little bit to some of what was a very different form, but what was on the air in the golden age. But I have to say, I think it's one of the worst tragedies in our culture that the television networks were allowed to make television, to substitute television for radio, and to pull all that wonderful drama and comedy and game shows and everything else off the air. I think that our culture would be richer had we been able to hang on to some of that.
Well, I'm afraid that's where we'll have to leave it, and recommend to our listeners, if they want to learn more about the Golden Age, that they take a look at your book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Michelle Hilmes, author of Radio Voices, American Broadcasting, 1922 to 1952. And this is Talking History.
He hunts the biggest of all game, public enemies that even the G-men cannot reach. The Green Hornet.
Mm-hmm.